From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Syrian Kurds push back on a Turkish plan. Possible genocide against Iraqi Yazidis. Plus, South Africa's Pistorius going to prison for killing his girlfriend. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Cases of Ebola are on the rise in Sierra Leone, with dozens of people falling sick each day, according to the government. So many people are dying that removing bodies is reportedly a problem. 49 confirmed cases of Ebola emerged in just one day on Monday in two Ebola zones in and around the capital. There are 851 total confirmed Ebola cases in those two zones. Britain's International Development Secretary Justine Greening arrived in Sierra Leone on Tuesday, along with 100 soldiers from the Royal Army Medical Corps, as part of the United Kingdom's response to the outbreak. On Tuesday, Greening observed UK training of health workers in Kerrytown.
One of the worst aspects of what's happened here in Sierra Leone is a breakdown of the healthcare systems. We've seen healthcare workers really on the front line, and also being many of the people who've lost their lives. This training is key. We're seeing some of it happening behind us to make sure we can get the healthcare system back up and running so we can treat people. And so healthcare workers who are really on the front line of this and doing the most dangerous jobs are far less at risk. And hopefully with this sort of training should be able to save lives without putting their own at risk.
Sierra Leonean authorities had to impose a curfew in the eastern town of Koidu on Tuesday following a dispute between youths and police over a suspected case of Ebola. Tensions between people and authorities have complicated efforts there to contain the deadly virus. In Guinea Tuesday, another hard-hit West African country, hundreds of residents in a neighborhood near the capital Conakry protested the construction of an Ebola treatment center nearby. Meanwhile, Rwanda Tuesday announced that travelers from the United States and Spain will be singled out for special training and screening, that is, if they have a temperature. They will be denied entry. World Health Organization said Tuesday tens of thousands of people in West Africa should begin receiving experimental Ebola vaccines. That would happen in January. Clinical trials in a number of countries are underway, are planned in Europe, the United States, and Africa. Trials will generate data on safety and protection before the vaccines can be rolled out early next year to groups including health workers. Dr. Marie-Paul Kinney is WHO Assistant Director General.
These trials will incorporate the largest number of volunteers and will be very important in terms of determining both the safety and the immunogenicity. And these data are absolutely crucial to allow decision-making on what dose level should go in the efficacy testing in Africa.
Kini had more to say on those vaccine trials.
And we expect both for the chimp adenovirus as well as from the VSV vaccine to have initial results. Of course, these trials will continue for 6 months to a year, but to have initial results about safety and immunogenicity, to have a choice of a dose level by the end of this year, so in December. That's clearly the plan.
The Ebola outbreak, which began back in March, has killed more than 4,500 out of nearly 9,200 known cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And at the United Nations on Tuesday, pledges to an Ebola trust fund have more than doubled to almost $50 million. Last month, the world body said it would need nearly $1 billion to halt the spread of the disease. In Washington, the U.S. Homeland Security Department said it is requiring all passengers arriving in the United States from Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone to fly into one of five airports equipped with enhanced screening for the deadly disease. The JFK Airport in New York became the first to begin the stepped-up screening on October the 11th. The other four airports, Newark in New Jersey, Dulles outside Washington, Hartsfield in Atlanta, and O'Hare in Chicago, began the new protocols last week. Screening measures include taking the passenger's temperature before admitting them into the United States. Five airports account for about 94% of travelers flying to the U.S. from the three West African nations that are the hardest hit with Ebola. The medical publication The Lancet reports a new research paper says, and I quote, Every month, three Ebola-infected people are likely to leave West Africa through air travel, unquote. It warns that if the epidemic persists and grows, it's likely that there will be more cases exported to other countries. The conclusions are based on flight itineraries, flight cancellations, and the number of new infections in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Cameron Kahn is one of the authors and is an infectious disease specialist and physician at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. He says there are potentially three different places to intervene in the Ebola crisis.
One, you can do this in your own country if you're unfortunate enough to receive an imported case of Ebola. You know, that obviously is not the ideal situation because there's clearly health and economic and even psychological impacts that can result from an imported case, as we're currently seeing in the U.S. The second area that you can focus on travelers who might be inadvertently moving Ebola virus to different parts of the globe.
Researchers studied how efficient or inefficient it was to screen travelers before they left West Africa and when they arrived in other countries.
Found was that you could actually screen all of the travelers that would be at high risk of being potentially exposed to Ebola virus just from three airports in West Africa. And the additional benefit of screening at the entry side when they're arriving in other countries is expected to be quite low because the travel times are fairly short and the incubation period, this is the time from which an individual is exposed to the time that they develop symptoms, is on average 8 to 10 days, can be as long as 21 days.
Kahn says the combination of exit and entry screening probably will not make much of a difference overall. But he adds stopping just one case helps.
I don't think that there's any significant harm from having that type of intervention take place. It's just that it's not likely to have a really meaningful impact in minimizing the spread of disease. And so finally, really, the only other frontier, the other option, is to decrease the number of new infections in the source countries themselves.
He says imposing travel bans to the U.S., Canada, and other developed countries is not the answer, as some would believe. Dr. Kahn says it all comes back to addressing the source of the problem.
Really, what we need to do is change the shape of the epidemic curve. And that basically just means rather than seeing increasing numbers of new infections, we need to actually turn this around so the number of new infections in the population is decreasing. And that's going to really require more intensive resources in the three affected countries, healthcare personnel, personal protective equipment, medical supplies.
He says that of nearly 500,000 travelers who flew on commercial flights out of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone in 2013, more than half were headed to five countries: Ghana, Senegal, Britain, France, and the Gambia. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Cuban doctors departing for West Africa to combat Ebola say they consider themselves lucky. Among the 15,000 who volunteered for the job, 256 were chosen. One of those doctors, Leonardo Fernandez, explained why so many of his colleagues are willing to undertake the risky mission. He said Cuban health professionals have been trained to care and go anywhere in the world to help when help is needed. Some 165 Cuban doctors and nurses have already arrived in Sierra Leone. Another 91 left Cuba Tuesday for six-month missions, 53 destined for Liberia, 38 going to Guinea. Cuba and its closest allies from Latin America and the Caribbean met in Havana on Monday to set up some plans to protect their countries from Ebola and to seek ways to help the people of West Africa. You can keep up to date on the Ebola outbreak at our website, voanews.com. All you have to do is click on our special coverage widget on the home page.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the fuel.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
For the landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Syrian activists are saying a U.S. airdrop with weapons and ammunition meant for Kurdish fighters near the border town of Kobani has fallen into the hands of the Islamic State militants. Here in Washington, a U.S. defense official said it's confident that 27 of the 28 airdrops actually landed in the right spot and were retrieved by the Kurdish fighters. But spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says no one in the Pentagon knows for sure if the stray bundle did fall into the hands of the Islamic State. Meantime, Syrian Kurdish leaders are pushing back on Turkey's plan to allow Iraqi Kurdish fighters to transit Turkish territory and to enter Kobani to help in its defense. Jamie Detmer has more from the Turkish-Syrian border.
Middle East politics is notoriously complex, and among the most Byzantine involves the Kurdish political parties who vie for top dog status and compete for the loyalty of all Kurds across Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. That competition appears to be coming to a head following Turkish officials announcing Monday they would allow Iraqi Kurds to cross Turkey to support the Syrian Kurdish city of Kobani. Now in its fifth week of a siege by militants of the Islamic State, some analysts argue the arrival of Peshmerga forces in Kobani would be a game changer. But Syrian Kurdish leaders are now pushing back on the Turkish idea, saying it is not a done deal and they should have been consulted before the announcement. In an interview with VOA, the spokesman for Kobani Kurds, Idris Nasan, said Kobani Kurdish approval should have been secured first.
From the beginning of these clashes, we declared that any forces want to come to Kobani to help in the resisting of Kobani, there must be some coordination with the Democratic Autonomous Administration because, you know, there is an administration in Kobani. Without this coordination, it's impossible to come to Kobani.
Monday's announcement of the Turkish plan came after intense U.S. and European pressure on Ankara to allow Kurdish reinforcements into Kobani, say European diplomats. Without a relief force, French and German politicians warned they might have to consider arming the Kurdish Defense Forces, or YPG, who are controlled by the Democratic Union Party, or PYD, the dominant party in Syria's Kurdistan. The PYD is an offshoot of Turkey's outlawed Kurdish separatist Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which is at loggerheads with Iraqi Kurds. The announcement that Peshmerga will be allowed to transit Turkey to help defend Kobani is seen by the PKK as a move by Ankara to alter the political dynamic in Syria's Kurdistan and to undermine the dominance of the PYD. Iraqi Kurds, who enjoy good relations with Ankara, agree with the Turks that an autonomous Syria Kurdistan should not be established. Asked if Peshmerga forces, ideological rivals of the YPG, could arrive today or tomorrow or this week, Idris Nasan appeared offhand and dismissive in his response.
Any specific information about coming or not coming of Peshmerga, it's just some declaration by the foreign minister, Turkish foreign minister.
While many Kobani refugees are pleased with the Turkish announcement, some express disapproval. Hazan, a farmer, said America is so powerful, it alone could stop the Islamic militants, and he wished U.S. airstrikes had started earlier. U.S. airstrikes, along with a stubborn YPG resistance, have stalled the offensive of the Islamic militants on Kobani, but the situation in the city is still precarious. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Surak.
A senior UN human rights official warned Tuesday that Islamic State militants in Iraq may be trying to wipe out the minority Yazidis. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Ivan Simonovic has just returned from a week in Baghdad and the Kurdish cities of Duhok and Erbil, where hundreds of thousands of displaced persons have fled to escape the terrorist group, also known as ISIL. He told reporters that there has been a dangerous spike in violence and that human rights violations are widespread and systematic. He warned that minority Yazidis, a mostly Kurdish-speaking people who practice a unique monotheistic faith, face particular danger.
Actions taken against Yazidi may amount to attempt of genocide. Why? Because they are defined by their religion and the only option they have is either to convert or to be killed.
Simonovich met several dozen Yazidis who fled ISIL-captured areas, including a 12-year-old girl who escaped sexual slavery, a father whose four sons were murdered because they refused to convert to Islam, and a boy who survived a mass execution. Simonovich said the Yazidis reported they were given the choice to convert to Islam or face execution. He said this differs from the experiences of some other groups, such as Christians, who were given the choices to convert, leave the area, or stay and pay taxes. The UN's Human Rights Office warns that ISIL is well-resourced, well-armed, and active in recruiting support from the local population and foreign fighters. They say the group's ruthless tactics are causing ethnic and religious divisions among communities to deepen. Simonovich urged community leaders, elders, and religious authorities to speak out and condemn violations of international human rights and humanitarian law and demand the care and protection of victims, no matter their ethnic, religious, or other affiliations. Violence has surged in Iraq this year. In September alone, the UN says more than 1,100 Iraqis were killed and nearly 2,000 were injured in acts of terrorism and violence. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Also in the news, a South African judge has sentenced to prison superstar athlete Oscar Pistorius for killing his girlfriend last year at his Pretoria home. VOA's Anita Powell was in the courtroom for the sentencing that brought an end to the nearly year-long trial.
Oscar Pistorius could spend as much as 5 years or as little as 10 months in prison for killing his girlfriend Reba Steenkamp, a sentence that is dividing opinion in a nation that has been riveted by his trial. Judge Tokozile Masipa took more than an hour to explain her sentence. She convicted Pistorius in September for culpable homicide, roughly equivalent to the American charge of manslaughter.
Hopefully, this judgment on sentence shall provide some sort of closure for the family and for all concerned so that they can move on with their lives. There's a delicate balance between the crime, the criminal, and the interests of society. The extent of the negligence in culpable homicide cases plays an important role in coming to an appropriate sentence, which should neither be too severe nor too light.
The athlete, who won international glory for being the first double amputee to compete in the Olympics, was immediately whisked to a holding area after sentencing Tuesday. Pistorius claims he mistook Reva Steenkamp, his girlfriend of 3 months, for a nighttime intruder and shot her dead through a locked bathroom door because he feared for his life. Under South African law, he must serve at least 1/6 of his sentence, about 10 months, before he can be considered for parole. The 5-year sentence is half the prison time prosecutor Harry Nell asked for. National Prosecuting Authority spokesman Nati Mube would not say whether the state will appeal. Pistorius could have faced up to 15 years imprisonment for culpable homicide. Reva Steenkamp's mother, June, left the court indicating to local reporters she thought justice had been served. The trial has riveted South Africa and is the first major criminal trial in the country to be broadcast live. Judge Masipa acknowledged that the case is unusual and has been affected by Pistorius's international fame, but said that did not affect her judgment. "I might add," she said, "that it would be a sad day for this country if there was one law for the poor and disadvantaged, and another for the rich and famous." But with Pistorius now behind bars, many South Africans are asking themselves, was justice done? Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
With 2 weeks to go until the U.S. midterm congressional elections, a handful of races around the country will decide which political party controls the Senate next year, possibly altering the balance of power in Washington. One of those Senate contests is in North Carolina, where a furious battle is underway for the seat now held by Democrat Kay Hagan. VOA's Jim Malone recently spent some time in North Carolina for our report.
But we'll be voting. Yes, we'll be voting.
Activists on both sides of the political divide have taken to the streets in North Carolina. Democrats are out to re-elect Senator Kay Hagan.
November 4th is around the corner.
While Republicans campaign on behalf of her challenger, Tom Tillis.
I'm okay with that.
Among those supporting Hagan is Melissa Reed of Planned Parenthood.
This is probably the most important Senate race in the country. The control of the Senate is really going to come down to three seats, and North Carolina is at the very top.
Reed opposes Republican efforts to limit abortion.
Women think that their policies are out of touch and that they are stuck in the past, and that's why we're dressed in 1950s garments today.
Anti-abortion protesters do their best to compete, trying to whip up support for Tillis. Tammy Fitzgerald says a strong turnout by social conservatives could swing the election to Republican Tillis.
A majority of people in the state are pro-life, about 55%, and especially among the conservative voters in the state, that's a larger number, about 70%.
The Senate race here in North Carolina is one of a handful of races around the country that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate next year. And if Republicans can take control away from the Democrats, it could have a huge impact on the final 2 years of Barack Obama's presidency.
Good evening, everybody. We finished the second debate.
Republican candidate Tillis is doing all he can to tie Hagan to President Obama and his low public approval rating.
I'm determined to make it clear that people know that Senator Hagan has voted with President Obama 96% of the time.
Hagan, like many Democrats around the country, wants to run on her own record.
Because he wants to make this election about the president. The president is not on the ballot. This race is about who's going to represent North Carolina in the U.S. Senate.
Local analyst John Davis says the president is playing a role in the North Carolina race, whether he wants to or not.
And right now his numbers are lousy. His job approval is in the low 40s overall. It's in the mid-30s on foreign policy. So this is a great time to, if you're a Republican, to tie your opponent to the president. Lousy numbers, it matters a lot in a midterm election year.
Libertarian candidate Sean Haugh could be a factor in a close race.
Entering into the race just with my own agenda.
Haugh fits in strategy sessions with supporters between pizza deliveries.
I personally wanted to walk into the voting booth in November and be able to vote for something other than more war and more debt.
Republicans have a lot riding on the North Carolina race, says free market advocate Mitch Kokai.
Most people think that if they're going to do it, North Carolina is probably one that they're going to have to win because Hagan would be one of the easier targets.
The campaign is intensifying in the final days, with both sides well aware of the national political stakes in the race. Jim Malone, VOA News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
One of the better-known figures in American journalism has died. Ben Bradlee, former executive editor of the Washington Post, who oversaw coverage of the Watergate scandal that toppled President Richard Nixon, was 93 years old. Bradlee died at his home in Washington of natural causes. After retiring, he wrote a memoir entitled A Good Life. That was in 1995, and he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama last year. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On October 22nd, 451, the Council of Chalcedon adopted a landmark church creed regarding the nature of Jesus Christ. The council's statement is generally accepted by both Protestant and Roman Catholic Christians. In 1797, Frenchman André Jacques Garnerin made the first significant parachute jump. He leaped from a hydrogen balloon nearly 1,000 meters above Paris. He failed to include an air vent at the top of his prototype. He oscillated wildly in descent, but landed safely, shaken but unhurt. October 22nd in 1844 was a day of anticipation for followers of American preacher William Miller, who had predicted the end of the world and the return of Christ. Nothing happened, and the following day became known simply as the Great Disappointment. Miller's followers later founded the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In 1879, Thomas Edison tested the first really successful incandescent electric lamp. Earlier attempts by other inventors had not resulted in a commercially viable method of producing light with electricity. In 1962, President John F. Kennedy announced that U.S. spy planes had discovered Soviet missile bases in Cuba from which nuclear missiles could be launched at major U.S. cities. He ordered a naval blockade of Cuba, telling Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev the threat would not be tolerated. After a tense two-week standoff, Khrushchev agreed to remove Soviet missile capability from Cuba, and Kennedy promised to refrain from interfering in Cuban internal affairs. Kennedy also agreed to remove U.S. missiles in Turkey. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States prides itself on its cultural, ethnic, and religious diversity. Each group of immigrants, whether it arrived in mighty waves in a short span of time or trickled in over decades, even centuries, made its contributions to every aspect of life in the United States. Without this diversity, we would not be the nation that we are today. But not every group is well represented among the U.S. population, and that is why every year the United States government makes available 50,000 immigrant visas to the citizens of countries with a lower rate of immigration to the United States. Registration for the 2016 Diversity Visa Lottery, also known as the Green Card Lottery, began at 1700 hours Greenwich Mean Time on October 1st and will end at 1700 GMT on November 3rd. Only citizens of countries sending fewer than 50,000 immigrants to the United States over the past 5 years are eligible. Other eligibility criteria also apply, such as having completed the equivalent of a high school level education or at least 2 years of qualifying work experience. For detailed information about entry requirements, along with frequently asked questions about the program, please go to the Department of State Bureau of Consular Affairs public website, travel.state.gov. All applications must be submitted electronically, and no paper applications are accepted. If you are eligible for the Diversity Visa Lottery and wish to immigrate to the United States, please visit the website at www.dvlottery.state.gov. Find the link to the lottery application at the bottom of the page and fill it out as soon as possible. Once you have submitted the entry, you will receive a confirmation page. Print it out and save it, as it contains your DV lottery registration number. You must have this registration number in order to check the website to see if your entry was selected. You should also retain access to the email account used for registration. Submit your entry only once, as submitting more than one entry will disqualify you. All DV lottery winners are chosen by a random drawing. Please do not wait until the last week to apply, as heavy demand might cause website delays. And remember, entry into the lottery is free. Anyone asking for money to help ease the process is running a scam. Once again, that website address is www.dvlottery.state.gov. Enter now, and good luck to you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.